Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crimes to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Kim Colton is filling in tonight for Susan. We'll open with a 1961 unsolved murder of Joan Butterbach in Wisconsin. Kim, take it away.
Thank you, Denny. In 1971, Joanne Butterbach vanished, and for almost 6 years, her family had no idea where she was or why she was gone. In 1977, Mark Van Osdale, 16 at the time, was fishing on Lake Tainter when he saw something strange protruding from the surface, through the surface of the water. What he saw ended up being Joanne Butterbach's car with her body in the trunk. According to the Dunn County Medical Examiner, Chris Cruz, the car was rigged to propel itself into the water without a driver. Tonight, let me please give a very warm welcome to Christopher Cruz, Chief Medical Examiner of Dunn County, Wisconsin. Thank you, Chris, for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Denny?
Yes, Chris, this is there's been some renewed interest in the Butterbach case, and I guess there's going to be some renovations or some changes to the terrain there about where the car was found. Would you tell us what's going on and why it's so important now to really refocus on this case?
You bet, Denny. Like was mentioned, the boat landing area where this vehicle was ultimately found is going to radically change here in the next few months. The backdrop of the bridge, the overhead supported bridge, and the immediate intersections, et cetera, are all going to be revamped and a new bridge installed, et cetera, just part of maintaining the roadway. So the picture that everybody's familiar with of that scene is going to dramatically change. This is one of two unsolved homicides here in Dunn County, and we revisit this stuff occasionally, and we try to envision different ways to think about it and different ways to make some progress on it. What I wanted to do is get that image solidified in the media prior to this radical change coming up, so we can possibly stimulate some traction on the case, maybe rejuvenate some memories from this homicide from so long ago. That was my motivation to get it done now. And also the fact, it is totally, it is an unsolved crime without too many leads at this point. So,
and Chris, it's my understanding that this is being treated as a homicide. I mean, it's not an undetermined. This is on the record as a homicide.
Yeah, it's absolutely a homicide. It's without question. The body was found, within a locked trunk. The contents of the trunk were removed and put in the back seat to make room for the body. There was an article of clothing around the victim's neck, tight. It was a ligature strangulation death. That was determined by autopsy back then. And also the vehicle was rigged. The air cleaner had been removed. It was also in the back seat. The spring on the throttle linkage was manipulated in a way to keep the throttle open instead of closed so it would propel itself. The car was found in gear. Automatic transmission found in drive. The lights were in the on position. The key was in the on position. The vehicle appears to have, like I mentioned, was rigged in a means to propel itself into the water. It appears that the vehicle probably hit a tree in that process with the right front, and glanced off the tree and then went into the water and submerged. So it's without question a homicide.
Kim, now you researched this case extensively.
Yes. Yes,
and in fact, can you tell us in addition to what Chris just said, and maybe I should direct this one last question to Chris for the time being. Chris, was there any way, you know, after the body having been apparently in the water for that length of time and so forth, could it, any indication like of sexual assault or anything, or couldn't that be determined?
The majority of the clothing items, I believe, were removed from the decedent. And, you know, like I say, an article of clothing was found around her neck. So it, in all likelihood, it was a sexual crime in its onset, and ended up, a homicide at its conclusion. So I think there's pretty good evidence to support that.
And Kim, in your research, what did you learn about the circumstances around the death?
Well, I'm the family spokesperson tonight. Her son called the Dunn County Sheriff's Department recently to inquire if the DCI would, the cold case team, because the money was set aside in Wisconsin, to have them look into crimes of this type. And in 1971, she was reported missing from her residence. And according to the family, this was just a normal day. She was going to St. Paul, Minnesota, from Waukesha, Wisconsin, to attend a reading of her uncle's will. She never made it, but they didn't realize that for 3 days. And that was valuable time lost. It wasn't until 1977 that her body was found. It's just agonizing for the family. But I have to say that Chris, thank you, Chris, so much for coming through for them, because without your help with all this and without your initiative, which you definitely took by calling the family, and it was just thank you so much from them. They want to make sure that you know how much this meant to them and how much closure they got from this because of your efforts. And
I appreciate that, Kim. There's really no thanks needed. You know, that's what we do. We try to take care of these victims the best we can. And
exactly.
This family has suffered just an enormous amount of trauma.
Right.
In the initial missing person, without really any knowledge for almost 7 years.
Yeah.
The whereabouts of their loved one, and then to have it end in this horrible means, it just, insult to injury on top of it. It's unimaginable what the family's going through.
Exactly. Go ahead, Denny.
I was going to say, can we talk for a minute about obviously this was a missing persons case to start with, and it probably was for the 6 or almost 7 years until the body was recovered. As far as the police investigation, both as a missing persons investigation and then subsequently as a homicide, today we rely so much on tracking cell phone records and this kind of thing. Going back 41 years, there weren't as many potential leads. Maybe the credit card things, about credit cards being used, and some of the stuff that investigators may rely on today may not be available and may not have been available back in 1971. So what did the investigation do? Was there any leads developed, like even before the body was found, as sightings of Mrs. Butterbach, perhaps in restaurants or gas stations, or any way to kind of track where she was during the day or where she was last seen?
You want to take that one, Kim?
Well, this was kind of a strange circumstance because the Waukesha PD said, "Oh no, no, please, we'll investigate. We don't want you to investigate." That's my understanding, Chris. Anyways, that's what they told the Dunn County Sheriff's Department is, "Oh, we'll take over. We're fine." And what happened was subsequently, whatever investigation they did in, oh gosh, I forget the year, but I think it was like later in 1990 or something, they transferred all their reports onto microfiche by volunteers, and it was lost. All the reports were lost. So we don't have any reports. We have nothing. Right. And
I think prior to the discovery of the decedent, there was an investigation obviously in place, and it was kind
true.
Of a mutual effort between Waukesha PD and Dunn County Sheriff's Department and DCI or Department of Criminal Investigation with the state. I believe some leads were developed, you know, as part of that missing person case. I do believe they had a credit card record for purchasing fuel early in the trip. That's all I'm aware of from prior to the body being found. Subsequent mm-hmm. to the discovery of the car and the decedent's, you know, in the trunk, that's what Kim was mentioning there. All those records and probably some of the stuff from the initial investigation as well were lost as far as mm-hmm. Waukesha PD's is concerned. The Sheriff's Department did kind of take a secondary role here after the body was discovered. The lead or the primary investigative agency was Waukesha, and Dunn County kind of disassisted them. As mm-hmm. such, Dunn County didn't generate a lot of reports. You know, the business has evolved, Danny, as you know, in the early days, the reporting certainly isn't as detailed and inclusive as it is today. You know, investigative techniques certainly have evolved, you know, considerably in 40 years, evidence preservation, et cetera. So it's just a difficult case in that there's not a lot of information to point to or to go to at this point as a reference. And unfortunately, there's no evidence left as well. Some of that stuff all of the evidence that was collected has been either misplaced or destroyed over the years. So
for the listeners who may be in my position, not be familiar with Wisconsin, the drive that Mrs. Butterback was taking that day, about how big a trip was that? Was it a couple-hour trip or how much driving did she have to do?
It's a substantial drive. It's northern mm-hmm. through a western suburb of Milwaukee to basically the middle northwestern part of Wisconsin. You know, we're about 50 miles straight east of mm-hmm. St. Paul here. So, you know, direct drive time back in the days prior to the completion of I-94, the freeway, I'm guessing it would probably be a 5 or 6 hour journey at least.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And was Mrs. Butterback, was she married at the time, separated, divorced, or what was her situation? Do we know?
She was married at the time, and everything was fine, like her son had told me. That day was just a normal day. She didn't often, she was from Minnesota, but she didn't often drive there alone. So this was kind of I think only one or two times prior to this, she did this trip on her own. Like Chris was saying, it's quite a long drive. And he was a prime suspect in the case. Chris, what would you say? Solely because of the fact that he had been in the CIA? It was just so out there. He had nothing to do with it, I'm sure. But he was definitely looked at it as a prime suspect, and they didn't really look any further than him.
Right.
Although he had alibi for that day, his boss said no, he was at work. It was just kind of, you know, in retrospect, it was ridiculous to think that, that this would be the case. But needless to say, they did. They thought that that was what happened. And unfortunately, with the pressures that went with this and some other personal issues, Mr. Butterbach ended up committing suicide about 2 years after Joanne disappeared. So he was not physically around when her body was found 6 years later. So
yeah. I think, you know, just I grew up in this area, you know, a couple miles from where the body was discovered. In fact, Mark Benazio and I are pretty good friends back then. And, the fact that, you know, we all heard this story that was just relayed by Kim there. And it, I think the local, for lack of a better term, mythology or whatever term you want to throw at this, the local lore back then at least was, well, you know, the husband probably did it. He's ex-CIA and he committed suicide 2 years after this thing. You know, it was the husband. Heck with it. We're done with it. And, you know, from the public's point of view, I think that was the perception. I think some of that public perception wore off on the sheriff's department here as well. And, you know, they kind of had other things to take care of. And there was another unsolved homicide in 74 that they were working real hard at that time as well, still in 1977. And I think, you know, by virtue of Waukesha PD kind of taking the lead on it, and then this subsequent, you know, the suicide that occurred, you know, it was kind of a low priority for, you know, it's hard to say that, but it was kind of a low priority for Dunn County, I think, at that point as well.
Yeah, and you're quite correct, I think, Chris. Well, once these legends or myths or lores or whatever you want to refer to it as takes hold, it's
urban
tough.
Legends.
Exactly.
Yeah,
urban legends.
Yeah. Tough to get rid of them.
It really is.
Once the seed gets planted, it becomes an obstacle. Now, again, I'm not familiar with that area. I'm just wondering, would it be more likely than not that for the person or persons who did this to have found or been to that boat launch area and so forth, would there be an indication, do you think, that they were probably locals or at least familiar with the terrain?
It would be my estimation that that's accurate, Denny. It's kind of a reasonably off the beaten path location, for lack of a better term, there as well. And the fact that, you know, there are two taverns pretty close to there. I would think it would be unlikely for somebody just to come upon that scene, evaluate it quickly, and say, hey, here's a good place to make a disposal of this person, knowing that, you know, it's a well-traveled highway, number one. There's actually a couple different county roads that come together there real close. You know, it's a well-traveled bridge. It's one of the few routes across the river. You know, a bridge is usually a more busy location. And then the fact there's two taverns right there, and it would tell me, you know, somebody local that knew when it was busy and when it was not busy. And also just the fact that that location was even chosen in the first place. It kind of sways
me. Let me ask Chris. I'm sorry, Chris.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was curious about something. First of all, Kim, in your research, when you spoke to Mrs. Butterbach's son, did she drink? I'm not saying alcohol, but did she like to stop for a beer on occasion that you know of?
No, she wasn't the type. She did drink. She did, but she did not stop at bars. She was not promiscuous. She did not, you know, this is 1971, mind you, and she would never pick up a hitchhiker. She would see her sons hitchhiking on the street, you know, to summer ride home. And mind you, again, this was, you know, late 60s, early 70s. And she would just drive right past and then give them heck when they got home for hitchhiking. She would never pick up a hitchhiker.
Let me throw this out there and see if maybe you can straighten me out, you and Chris, on what I'm thinking. Unless The vehicle apparently was operational. It was driven into the river, apparently, with the accelerator, you know, set and so on and so forth. I'm trying to think of how the person or persons who did this to Mrs. Butterback got a hold of her. And if the car was not, like, disabled, you know, or she was parked alongside of the road with a flat tire or some type of mechanical issue where a passerby would stop and maybe, you know, decide to do something. And if the car wasn't, no evidence that it was run off the road, where somebody forced her off the road to get to her. I'm just, where would it be logical that the killer or killers, how did they get her in their clutches? Does anybody have a theory on how that happened?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, Danny, and the only plausible thing I can think of that fits in the way I put it together in my head, at least, is, you know, she fueled up reasonably close to Waukesha. If you do the math, you know, and we didn't have a contiguous freeway between us at that point. There was, you know, state highway and federal highway and then a patch of freeway. And the likelihood of getting all the way to St. Paul on a tank of gas, I think, in a 1971 V8 Mustang is, you know, probably pretty slim. So she probably stopped for fuel again, I'm thinking, some proximity to Dunn County. That would have given an opportunity maybe somebody to sneak in the back seat or, you know, take her by force maybe at you know, someplace reasonably close to here. Maybe even the exit right here at the freeway, you know, that would have connected to the scene, exit 45 on 994 here in Dunn County, potentially even that close to the scene, you know, 3 or 4 miles away. The damage to the vehicle is likely have been done with that impact of the tree. They matched up some green paint on the tree to the car, so we're pretty sure the car hit that tree at that time. The right front tire, I believe, was down, and the tie rod end was broken on that side as a result of that impact. So the car was not drivable after that impact. But like I say, there's pretty good evidence that that impact occurred right there at the boat landing. So my guess is the car was drivable. Somebody somehow got in the vehicle, took her by force at that point, maybe incapacitated her and took her to that location, or, you know, it's conjecture at this point.
So we then, Chris, are probably relatively safe based on what Kim said about Mrs. Butterback's, you know, not being a BART person that's going to be stopping, especially probably a strange joint.
Right. And
if she wasn't first off the road, a gas station would have been probably the most likely place where someone would have seen her, you know, where she could have been taken control of. You know, back in the 70s, early 70s, late 60s era, it seems to me that back then a lot more gas stations had mechanics on duty. I mean, it wasn't all the convenience store stuff back then. There used to be actually, you know, garages.
True.
You know, what I'm thinking is, I personally, when it comes to a car, I know nothing. I get in and pray that when I turn the key on, it starts, okay? So whatever had to be done to have this car, you know, as far as the accelerator and the air cleaner and these different things that happened, I wouldn't have been able to do that, okay? So I'm thinking maybe whoever did it, or it could be just a young fellow that took auto mechanics or something, or was a car nut, or it could be an actual, possibly professional mechanic. I mean, it had to be somebody that knew a little bit about cars.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great point. The that exit I mentioned had a little service station associated with it. It was a mobile station with a one or two bay mechanics bay in there. Long since gone. It is a convenience store at this point, but that is a interesting possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was thinking, you know, when I heard that, I said, geez, I said, if I were to commit that type of crime, I would never be able to do that piece of it, because there's no way I could rig a car. I just don't have the knowledge to do that. Mm-hmm. The other thing I might ask, how close, I'm just thinking, if somebody got into her car, say at a gas station, and forced her or incapacitated her and took her to this area. I'm just wondering how, presumably, unless somebody followed them in a separate vehicle or whatever, after they ran the car into the lake, they would be on foot. Was it a fairly easy walking distance to civilization, or would,
yeah,
would somebody...
Yeah, it really is. There's, like I said, there's these two taverns right across the river, opposite side of the river, and it's a reasonably well-traveled road, and it's within 4 or 5 miles of that exit I just mentioned, and maybe six or seven miles of Menominee, Wisconsin. So it's it's a lake area with a cottage community on the lake there.
Did you say, Chris, when you were talking about the condition of the vehicle, did you say the headlights were on?
Yes, sir.
The switch was on.
Switch was on.
So that
headlights
means they were doing
on and drive, and the key was in the on position.
So would it be logical to assume that they did the deed or did the car piece of it, running the car in at night?
That would be my assumption, yeah. Correct.
So I'm just wondering, what time did she leave? On her? I'm just trying to figure how long, you know, did she leave, like, in the afternoon, or if she left in the morning, and they disposed of
the
car at night, they had her for a while.
Yeah, they did. I think they did. She left in the morning, and she had this appointment, and Chris, I'm not sure what time the appointment was. She had to be in St. Paul at a certain time in the afternoon that day. So it's she left in the morning, and she never showed up for the appointment, but none of this was made known until like 3 days later, of course. But so something happened, and I think exactly what you're saying, Denny, that it happened at a gas station or something like that, but there are attendants. But then again, you have to figure that they didn't even know a crime was committed until 6 years later. So who was there? Who was working? Who remembered? Who knew? You know, and that's what makes it so hard.
And I think, too, we talked a little bit earlier about whether there was a sexual assault, and Chris said he would lean toward that.
Oh, yeah.
But
if
they had Mrs. Butterback in their his or their possession or control from sometime, mm-hmm. you know, midday or noonish or late morning or whatever, until they had to have the headlights on to get the car into the lake, I think that would tend to even more, you know, support that contention that they were doing something for a certain amount of time.
Exactly. And Chris, I know that when I spoke to the current sheriff, he was a deputy back then, and he was saying that, wonderful guy too, by the way, I mean, fantastic, but he was saying back then that, you know, the streets kind of, when the bars closed at, I think he said one, the streets were quiet. There was nobody out there. And I just feel that the perpetrators must have known that they had this amount of time to rig the car. I mean, because that, like Denny was saying, how would you even know how to do that? Okay, so you know how to do it, but it's still going to take you time to do it.
Sure.
And you have to rig the car. You have to be secure in your knowledge that nobody's going to come along, that you're okay, that you've got time to do this, and that you can make this happen. It just really seems to me like it was somebody who definitely knew the area. I'm not going to go out as far as to say that it was a local, but somebody who really, you know, who knew the area, who knew the habits of the township. This is, even to this day, is kind of a small town it's a beautiful town, actually. I would love to retire there. But, you know, it's a beautiful place, but wonderful. But it's still kind of like that small town thing going on, and I'm sure it was even more so back then. So it just makes me think that somebody, that they knew the habits of the citizens.
And I think about
the suspects. I mean, you know, I was told that, well, there were suspects, but they had alibis. I can't stop thinking about, can we go back and re-interview these people? Can we? A lot of things hinge on that kind of thing. You know, like somebody misses something or, oh, yeah, okay, well, he had an alibi. But they didn't quite follow up. And later, years later, it comes to, you know, light that, well, this person actually didn't have an alibi. Just different things come into my mind. What are you thinking about all that?
And even to remember, I mean, just think of yourself right now, and where was I 6 years ago on this day?
Oh, I know.
And
true.
There's just no way I could even come close to being accurate with something like that. And for law enforcement to rely on someone's memory to,
yeah,
to
that's
absolutely
true.
Verify with some kind of employment record, it would be next to impossible to.
That's true.
I mean, for the fact that somebody would even say they had an alibi, you know, would be suspicious, I think, after 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
We've run out of time. This has been fascinating to talk about. And if anybody has any information about this case, who should they contact?
You bet, Denny. We've got the county has set up a Crime Stoppers website, and it's just the normal prefix, and then it's Dunn County, D-U-N-N County, all one word, .crimestoppersweb, all one word, .com. There's a link in there to Joan's case and a means to either text or email a tip anonymously. You can call an 800 number, 855 toll-free number. It's actually 855-TIP-DUNN, T-I-P-D-U-N-N. And you can leave an anonymous tip, or you can, you know, use the internet, et cetera, or text. So there's a link there with her picture and some detail of the case, et cetera.
Well, Chris, thank you very, very much for being with us, and I wish you the best of luck with this, you and the Butterbach family. Hopefully that this thing can get resolved and reach some resolution for the family.
Certainly appreciate the venue, Denny, and the family I know is, you know, is very appreciative of the efforts and very appreciative of anybody that could help. So
definitely, and they just want you to know, Chris, how much you helped them and how blessed they are to have you in their lives. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Good night.
Good night now.
September 4th, 2008, 33-year-old Daniel Ray Underwood, his girlfriend Rebecca Nelson, and a friend, Maria Harvick, were at a bar in East Fork, Texas. The three then went back to the home Daniel and Rebecca shared in Springs, Texas. According to Maria, once there, Daniel and Rebecca got into an argument, and Maria left the room. A short time later, she went back into the room and saw Daniel holding a shotgun in his right hand and accusing Rebecca of taking all his money and burying him in debt. Rebecca grabbed the gun and the struggle ensued. Maria again left the room, and a few seconds later, she heard the gun go off. When she stepped back into the hallway, she saw Daniel fall to the floor, mortally wounded. Was Daniel's death an accident, a suicide, or a homicide? The answer might depend on who you talk to and when. Tonight, Daniel's mother, Donna Underwood, and Maria Harvick will bring listeners the latest updates about Daniel's case and where it stands today. And Donna, welcome back to CrimeWire.
Thank you, Danny.
And Maria, thanks for coming on the show.
Hello?
Is she there?
Yes.
Thank you, Hello? Maria.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Donna.
Yes.
It's been a while since we talked about this case. Can you tell us where the case stands today? Has there been any changes since we were on the air last time?
Well, the changes that's come about is that Maria has made contact with our family, and she has told us what actually happened that night. and she's ready to tell the authorities.
Thank God.
Thank God is right. Maria.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you've been in touch, obviously, with the Underwood family. What had to go through your mind? I mean, what was the decision process like for you to decide that you wanted to cooperate with the Underwoods and be able to get the truth out as to what happened the night Daniel died?
Well, at first I just didn't want to talk it because I guess I was still in shock. And yeah. I didn't know how to talk to his mother and tell her what I knew. I just held back until I kind of just started processing it, I guess, myself, till I got brave enough to go ahead and talk to her about what really happened.
And, Donna, when you got this phone call from Maria, what was that like?
I was just amazed. I could tell the first time I had talked to her that she was really traumatized by it, and she, you know, was telling parts of it because that's all she could remember. But she does know that Rebecca had threatened her not to say anything, so that was a reason too. Even in, you know, with her being traumatized and in shock.
Yes.
Is it okay? And I don't want to do anything tonight that would jeopardize any type of investigation. So if I ask any questions or Kim asks any questions that you're uncomfortable mm-hmm. with or would rather not answer, please don't. Because the last thing
right.
I want to do is do anything that would cause problems, okay?
Exactly.
But, with that in mind, Maria, mm-hmm. could you tell us what happened the night in 2008?
Well, I was at work, and Rebecca called me trying to get me to come to the ball and have some beers, which I thought God never called to ask Matt to go out drinking with them. But I told her I was at work, and I didn't get off till 8. She texted, but then I got off and went to the 127, which was a different bar, and I was just going to have one beer and go home. But I got a call from a friend of mine named Robin who said that we had decided that we were supposed to meet at the Texas Lounge. So I told her, oh, okay, I forgot. So I went ahead to go meet her over there, and Rebecca had texted me again. So I told her I was already headed that way because I forgot I was supposed to meet Robin there. When I was there, her and Daniel were playing pool. They'd already been there for a while. And had a few drinks. Was a fight out there that some girl started a fight with me. Rebecca got into it, and then they both started fighting. It got pretty bad, so we just decided we were going to leave. Rebecca wanted to go to East Fork. And Daniel really didn't go, but she talked him into it until he finally said yes. I told her I had to go to Walmart to get a phone charger for my new phone that I put them at Daniel's house. Okay, so my friend Robin was going to follow them to Daniel's house, and I went to Walmart. I couldn't find my charger, so I went to Daniel's house, and I was a lot closer to that. Yes, they must have had another drink before they left, because I waited there outside for a while before they finally showed up. When they showed up, we went inside. Daniel gave me a beer and got him one. We sat waiting for Rebecca to change because the fight shirt had tore or stretched out, had to redo her hair. So while we waited, we drank our beer. We were there long enough to finish one beer, and then she was finally ready. We all got up, and we were all going to ride in two different vehicles, but Rebecca decided she wanted all of us to ride with her on the Dodge Durango. So we all rode with her. She drove. The whole way there, she was already kind of swerving a little bit, but not too bad. Daniel seemed to be in a good mood the whole way there. So when we got there, he offered to buy us all our first round. Rebecca signed us up for karaoke as soon as we walked in. She sang a couple songs, and then I think we all sang one song. And then her and Daniel decided to play pool. And while they were playing pool, me and Robin sat back at a table by the bar, which we could still see them. They weren't, but maybe I want to say 20 feet away from us. And I seen them kind of arguing. Well, then after a little bit, Rebecca come back to our table, and she was upset. And I asked her what was the matter. She said she was mad because Daniel wanted to keep playing, and she didn't. But she just ignored it, and Daniel stayed over there playing. And then she kept turning over to me, whispering in my ear, look at him over there. Y'all look at him. She said he was flirting with some man's wife over at the pool tables, which he wasn't. But she was just saying he was. Well, after a little bit, Daniel called me over there, and he asked me if I'd get him some quarters for pool. So he gave me some ones, and I went to the bar, and I got a couple quarters or a few quarters, took them over to him, and then he gave me some money and told me to buy us another round. So I got us another round and brought him back to the table, took him his, and went back and sat down. After a little while, Daniel come up to Rebecca and tried to kiss her, and she turned away. And he said, what's the matter? Come play pool. She didn't want to play no more. And so he said, okay, well, I'm going to play one more, and then I'll come back and sit down. So he did. After he come back to sit down, there was another guy that had come in named Dusty. He was supposed to meet Rebecca to she sang. She was going to sing, and he played his guitars, a guy named Dusty. And Daniel didn't know, so we were going to introduce him to Dusty first, just out of respect. And then it was up to him if he would allow her to do that or not. They ended up not even doing that. I guess everybody drank too much. She drank too much. She said she couldn't sing no more. She didn't even karaoke no more. So after a little bit, we just went on home. We drove home. Rebecca drove again all the way back, and she was swerving really bad this time. And Daniel was just kind of with his head down, with his head in his hands. It wasn't really saying much, and I asked him what was the matter, and he said nothing. He just seemed kind of down or like he was thinking, I don't know. So when we got almost close back to Sulphur Springs, she said she wanted to stop back at the Texas Lounge where they had gotten she had gotten that fight to pick up some pills from the bartender there. So we stopped in there and got some pills. And then she wanted to make two stops at the bank. We made one stop at one bank, and I don't remember which bank it was, but she used his card, and it didn't take it. So she kind of got upset about it, and he said, well, I don't know. Let's try another bank. So they went to another one, and I can't remember for sure, but I think it was City National maybe, something like that. But anyway, the card worked. I didn't see how much money she got out of it or nothing, but we ended up just going back to the house. When we got to the house, Robin didn't even go in the house. She just said goodbye to us. Daniel hugged her, told her he had a good time, and it was glad that she could come. And then he invited her to go with us for Rebecca's birthday party, which was coming up. He wanted to take us all to the boats and play at casinos. So she said, okay, yeah, for sure. So everybody said goodbye to Rob, and she left, and we all went in the house. We sat down on the couch. Daniel sat by the refrigerator. He had a big couch, and he always sat by the refrigerator. And he grabbed a beer again and gave me one, and he got himself one. Rebecca wanted me to watch some movie, a DVD that she had rented, George Lopez. And so I was like, okay. So she was trying to find it. She couldn't find it. She was trying to talk to Daniel, and he wasn't paying attention. Yeah, I guess he was in his thoughts because he had his head down again, just like he was thinking. So since he wasn't paying attention to her, she took a DVD and threw it at him, but it missed him. So she picked up another one and threw it at him again, and this time it hit him in the leg. And he just kind of looked up like, what? And it kind of seemed like they were going to argue, so I got up and went to the bedroom to go ahead and change into my clothes. And I called my boyfriend at the time and just telling him we got back home and thought they was going to argue. And then while I was on the phone with him, Rebecca hollered for me. So I put the phone down and I went out, and I looked left because when you look out of my bedroom, there's a hallway, and I looked left and looked into the living room, and I didn't see them in there. But when I looked to the right, they were at the end of the hallway standing there. So I walked over there, and he was holding the gun standing in front of him for the hallway. And I walked over there, and I asked what was going on. I told him, you know, what are you doing? And he was hollering at her, telling her why did you do that? What do you want me to do? What do you expect me to do? I just checked my emails or my bank account on his laptop, and he said, I've got like $42 or $46, something like that, left in his account. And he was asking her where it all went, what happened to it. And he's just, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? And she started crying and saying, don't do this, don't do this. You're scaring me. And I just looked at him and I told him to hand me the gun. And he just looked straight at me. I was standing on his right side. He just turned his head and looked at me and said, it's not a gun, it's a shotgun. And I was like, okay, just give it to me, whatever it is. And then he just turned away from me. He didn't even say anything to me or nothing else anymore after that. He just, all he said to me. And she had put her hands on the barrel of the gun. He only had one hand on the trigger. His finger was on there. He had his left hand holding the top barrel, and then she had her hands above his, and she was trying to pull at it. And I told her not to because I could see his finger was right on the trigger, so I didn't want her to make it go off. So I told her to let go, and she wouldn't. So I just put my hands on her arms and told her to just let go. I got her to let go. Well, then I didn't know what to do. I was scared, so I went back in the bedroom and called my boyfriend back and told him he needed to get over here quick because Daniel had a gun and they were arguing, and I didn't know what to do. So he said, okay, I'm headed that way. So I go back. When I got to step back in, they're still arguing, but I could hear them. She hollered for me again. So I ran back out there, and I still had my boyfriend on the phone. I just set the phone down, and so he could hear everything that was going on. And when I went back in to get the phone and talk to him, he said he was almost there. It's when I heard the shot right when I got back to the door to step back out. I heard the shot right as I stepped out of the door, and they weren't but maybe a few feet from me then because my bedroom was right in the hallway. So as soon as I stepped out, I seen him fall. I had already heard the shot and everything. I just seen him fall down on his left side. She shoved the gun back, removed his body. She rolled him over. His legs landed on the gun then. She started going hysterical. I didn't even know what to do. So I just ran over there to him, and I started telling her, call 911, call 911. And she was like, no, wait, because I started to go get the phone and call 911, and she said, no, wait. So I was like, what do you mean, wait? And she was like, I don't know, just hold on. I said, no, we ain't got time. Look, he's still alive because he was still breathing. So she thought, I'll do it. So she ran into the living room, and she grabbed his phone. I don't know why she grabbed his phone instead of hers. She grabbed his phone and called 911, but they couldn't understand her. She was just screaming and crying and bawling. She went nailed down beside him, and she started smearing her hands on his chest and his head, and there was blood. She was smearing the blood on herself, on her chest, her face. She was just taking his blood and smearing it on herself instead of trying to help him. And so I told her, you know, he's choking on his blood, you know, turn his head. And she didn't even, she was, I don't want to touch him. Well, you were just touching him. So I reached over and I turned his head sideways so he could spit that blood out. And then I took the phone from her and started talking to the 911 operator. And she told me just to stay on the phone until the cops got there. They were on their way. So this whole time she's just sitting there. Okay, go ahead.
Maria, and then there came a time when she told you not to talk to the cops or not to tell them exactly what happened?
Yeah, she told me not to tell them what had happened. She told me not to tell them that they'd gotten an argument earlier that day at the bar and something else. I forgot this last time, too, and I can't remember it. She told me to tell them that I was her friend and not his.
And when the police did their investigation, what did you tell them? Did you tell them everything or did you kind of hold back?
I don't think I told them that they'd gotten an argument, and then I did tell them that she was my friend and not him the first interview. But then after I talked to Ms. Dawn on the second interview from the cops, I told them the truth that he was my friend, not her. And I told them that they'd gotten an argument on it, but the first time I didn't because she had told me not to, and, well, she's a big girl.
So
I was scared, I guess.
So there had been arguing going on, you know, during the evening and so forth, and then you said that Daniel apparently checked his bank accounts or something on the internet and found out that he'd been. Donna, do you know, or either one of you know, what how much money we're talking here? What he should have had in the bank?
Well, I can tell you that in less than a month, it was just a little over 3 weeks, he had gotten his 401k from where he worked, and he had gotten $25,000. And that was $42 was left, and it was less than a month's time, and that's all that was left. And he was accusing her of his cash missing.
Mm-hmm. So he felt she'd been into his money.
Yes.
Kim, do you have any comments or questions?
Well, I just think that, Maria, you wanted to call 911 right away, and she was like, no, no, wait. And may I also say that everything that you're saying tonight in your, you know, the statement that you're making tonight is exactly what you've been saying for years. I mean, since this happened, and it hasn't changed, and I just thank you.
I still have nightmares
coming
about
forward.
It.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. And when she says, "No, wait," you know, and I can't imagine the nightmare you were in when this happened.
Yes, the thing is, I wasn't. I was going through divorce, and Daniel lived a block from my kids, so I still had to go every morning and get my kids ready for school. So Daniel offered to rent me a room out. I wasn't supposed to move in for another couple of weeks, but she talked me into coming and staying that night. I had only took like one bag to the house.
Oh.
She never called me to hang out or nothing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Never called to hang out before or nothing until that night, and then talked me into staying that night.
And then she was telling everybody that she was Daniel's beneficiary right then before he died.
Oh, yes. Yes,
When the cops got there, they made us step out. She wouldn't come out. I was still on the phone with 911. As soon as we stepped out the door, I told 911 the cops were there so she said I could hang up. So I hung up, and I offered the officer the phone. I said, this is his phone. Do y'all need it? He said, no. As soon as he said no, Rebecca took the phone and started calling the bar owner and everything, people that didn't really know him, and just started telling them, Daniel just shot himself, and he made me the beneficiary.
Oh.
Those were exact words.
Oh,
she
my gosh.
20, 30 people
Denny,
that night.
What do you think of that? OMG.
Was there actually an insurance policy? Does anybody know?
There was some for his kids. There wasn't anything else. But she thought
$25,000. Mm-hmm. She got the $25,000, so you know.
Now there was some talk, I believe, that Rebecca may have had a relationship, and I'm not talking sexual, but a working type relationship with the police. She may have been a confidential informant or something, which could have affected how they treated her during the investigation. Is that still on the table? Is that still what is believed?
Well, on the interviews that she has with the cop or the detective, she says something about tips that she'd give him on other cases, and he said that she had worked with him or talked to him about other cases. And this was on the interviews. And she kept calling him her good friend, the detective that was doing the case.
So officially, this was ruled what, an accident or a suicide?
Suicide.
Oh God.
And do you have any reason to believe? Well, either of you, Donna, or you were right there, Maria. Was there any talk, to your knowledge, that night that Daniel was on the verge of suicide? Did you see any indication of that?
No, he was making plans ahead of time, and he was supposed to get his boys was going to move in, and. And everything, and she was the one. I know when the gun had went off, she had put her hands back on it, and then she had told the cops that she didn't touch it. And then another time she changed and said she put her finger on the tip of the barrel, which she never did. And she told the cops she tried to put his brains back in, and she never did. Only thing she ever touched him for was to get his blood and smear it on herself.
Yeah.
And did somebody say that, okay, she said that she was the beneficiary of some insurance policy that apparently didn't really exist, but she apparently had, as far as we know anyway, somebody got that money. Presumably
well,
it was her.
She was trying to say she was beneficiary to everything, his vehicles, everything.
Okay. So, do you know if the police did a financial investigation of her just to see where everything was or what she had or what she might have taken?
I don't think so.
Not that I know of.
I believe it was her second interview, wasn't it, Donna, where the cops didn't even really interview her about the case. About that night, they were more worried about what the rumors were between her and the officer.
Yeah.
And the interview you said, Donna, you mentioned, is that on YouTube or somewhere? Is that somewhere where people can look at it?
Yes, it's on YouTube. It's.
Do you know the link for the?
No,
you can
type in. Daniel Underwood, and you should be able to come to it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And that's the actual interview she did with the police?
Yes, it's cut into parts. There's several parts of them.
I also want to say, before, because we're almost running out of time, but Rebecca did agree to take a polygraph test about the facts of that evening, but backed out after consulting with her attorney. However, she told numerous people that she did take the test and passed it with flying colors.
Yes.
Just want to add that in.
That's true.
Yeah. Maria, we're running out of time, but I just want to say God bless you, and I think of you often, and I think of you highly. And Maria,
yes.
God bless you too. And I'm so glad that you are stepping up to this, and thank you so much. Denny?
Yes, I know you want me.
Donna?
Yes.
Yeah, when we first started, when I asked about if there was anything new, and you said that Maria was now ready to tell her story to the authorities, where does that stand? Are they interested in talking to her, or is there anything going on where they want to, do an interview of her?
We were trying to get the Attorney General to step in, and we're still waiting on that.
Okay, now, so far, the only, one police agency's been involved to this point?
No, the Rangers was involved at the very beginning, and the only time I have talked to him is I called him after Maria told me that Daniel fell in a different position because he was laying on the gun. And I asked the Ranger how he made the determination that Daniel hit his leg against the door facing and fell on the gun, and he got mad, and he says, are you trying to say I didn't adequately investigate the case? And I said, no, sir, because I knew, the story that Maria told me, and I didn't even get to tell him that she had told me it was different. So, she had, Rebecca had moved Daniel's body.
And Maria, you actually saw that, right? Saw
yes.
Rebecca reposition the body?
Yes.
So that that's an actual eyewitness.
No, yes, I saw it. Everything that I say is I saw it.
Well, listen, we are almost out of time. I'd like you, hopefully, you're going to hear from the Attorney General real soon and get this thing moving forward again. Would you please keep in touch with us and let us know?
Yes, we sure will.
Thank you.
Ladies, thank you so much for being on. And Maria, like Kim said, all the credit to you for having the courage to come out and tell what went down and tell the truth. That's outstanding. I mean, it's just great. And and good luck to you and Donna. God bless you for staying with it and not giving up.
Thank y'all so much.
Thank y'all.
Okay, good night, ladies.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks to our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday, June 19th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Remember, we ensure voices will be heard when no one turns. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless the CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night, Cam. Good night, everyone.